Court will proceed to the next case, Baker versus IPB Incorporated. Mr. Foster?
May it please the court, I am Howard Foster for the appellant in this case. The district court focused on the issue of Garmin preemption in dismissing the case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Didn't address the other issues. I will start there and reserve a few minutes for rebuttal. The standard that the district court applied here was inconsistent with the standard that this court enunciated on the question of Garmin preemption of other federal statutes in Palumbo Brothers in 1998, which has since been followed in only in one published opinion of a district court.
I wonder, counsel, whether Garmin preemption matters in a case like this. Who would own the potential RICO claim here if there were any? Wouldn't it be the union, the exclusive bargaining agent?
That issue was raised. The union hasn't suffered any damage here because the union doesn't earn any wages.
Exactly, but since this is, in the end, about the level of wages, that's the claim of damage.
Yes.
And there is a collective bargaining agreement.
Yes.
One would think that this claim belongs to the union. And therefore, unless one can show a violation of the duty of fair representation, we just have the wrong plaintiff here.
The union can't complain about the fact that the company is employing illegal immigrant workers.
Why can't it?
Because
if the employer doesn't pay the wages specified in the collective bargaining agreement, the union can complain.
Yes.
Even though the wages aren't paid to the union, they're
yes.
paid to the workers.
Yes.
Right. The idea of exclusive bargaining representative is that the union is the workers' representative for all matters concerning wages and working conditions.
Yes.
And this appears to be a case about wages and working conditions. That's why I'm asking this question.
If the union cannot say to the employer, IBP, we refuse to represent these people who are illegal immigrant workers, and we ask you to stop hiring them because wages will go up. Under Shorthand, the union is obliged to treat them as employees. And in fact, the union was doing its job in negotiating the highest wage that it could for this group of employees as they were hired by IBP. Had IBP not been hiring illegal immigrant workers en masse and doing so knowingly, the union would have had the ability to negotiate higher wages for these workers. But because the union was breaking the law, the workers paid the price. The union has done its job, Judge Easterbrook, and for that reason, the workers are the directly injured party here. The Southern District of Illinois faced this question of Garmin preemption in Mariah Boat, which we cited in our brief, and said specifically, although all of the underlying acts are arguably protected or prohibited by the National Labor Relations Act, none of the predicate acts are premised on labor law alone. Drawing all inferences in favor of the plaintiff, the court finds that none of the predicate acts exist solely because of federal labor law and rejected Garmin preemption. There is no criticism of that analysis of this court's decision in Palumbo since Mariah Boat was entered in 1998. Mariah Boat took the position there is a strong presumption against preempting RICO claims under Garmin, and in fact, it cannot be done unless the practice that is being complained about is solely illegal by virtue of labor law, which IBP doesn't contend here. There is a predicate act that directly applies, and that's why this case can't be preempted under this court's interpretation of the preemption principles as enunciated in Palumbo and followed in Mariah Boat. The court were to find that, in fact, as Judge Easterbrook has said, that the union could somehow be said to have been damaged because the company...
No, may just not be understanding my question. Maybe I haven't been sufficiently clear. My question was not, was the union damaged? But is the union, as the employee's exclusive representative,
yes,
the holder of this claim on their behalf? And that would then lead to the question, did the union violate its duty of fair representation in failing to take this kind of claim up as the employee's champion?
Well, I understand your point, Judge Easterbrook, and as I understand it, if the union were to have some argument to that effect, that it has been damaged by this illegal immigrant hiring scheme.
I guess I should give up. My point has nothing to do with whether the union was damaged. Nothing at all to do with that question.
Okay. I do not believe that the union could assert this claim on behalf of the workers. And even if somehow it could, that shouldn't preclude the plaintiffs from bringing their own claim, as they have done here, nor has either the district court nor IDP in its briefs cited any authority which would prevent the workers from bringing their own case. The arguments...
Are Baker and Enyart members of the union?
They were represented by the union in that their wages were set by a collective bargaining agreement. I believe that IBP is in fact a closed shop, so that yes, all the workers are required to pay union dues and therefore are members of the union. But the union has done nothing about this. And so that the employees are suing because their wages were depressed, and under RICO they have the right to sue as they have been the directly injured party here. The proximate causation requirement that wouldn't permit any other party to, as IBP has argued, to be more directly injured, making this claim one of indirect injury, rendering it too speculative or too remote, or for some other reason, resulting in the conclusion that the plaintiffs do not have standing to sue under RICO. Under the Holmes Supreme Court analysis, the plaintiffs have suffered a monetary injury. It was proximately caused by the predicate acts that's alleged, and therefore they have standing to sue under Holmes. This analysis has been followed in the Second and Ninth Circuits in similar cases alleging this particular predicate act. The Ninth Circuit in Mendoza versus Zirkle Food Company being the most apt, involving worker claims for depressed wages. I would also like to address the question of the RICO enterprise. Although the district court did not find this was a basis for dismissing the case here, IDP has argued in its brief that the claim does not adequately describe a RICO enterprise sufficiently under Federal Rule 8 and is therefore subject to dismissal on that basis. I contend that we have argued in our brief that the RICO enterprise meets the standards of 8, of Rule 8, in that it alleges there are members of the association and enterprise that have been associated, in fact, over years. They are not part of a single corporate family. They are not owned by a single entity. The case is distinguishable from the cases that IBP has asserted on this argument, namely the Fitzgerald-Emery line of cases on RICO enterprises that have come down from this court in the last several years. We're not talking about a parent and its subsidiaries here. Every member of this enterprise was, none of the members, of this enterprise were employed by or subsidiaries of or otherwise owned by IBP. They have all associated together independently for financial gain. I will be happy to take questions and then reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Foster. Mr. Johnson?
Please the court. David Johnson, I'm here on behalf of IBP, the appellee and cross appellant. I'd like to focus on two of the issues raised here by the appeal and cross-appeal, first being the issue of Garmin preemption, and then with regard to RICO, I'd like to focus my comments, subject to any questions on any other subject matter, on the enterprise issues, that is, whether there is an association, in fact, enterprise here, and whether or not the association, in fact, enterprise has been operated through a pattern of racketeering activity. The Garmin preemption principle is a fundamental principle of labor law. It protects the integrity and the primacy of the National Labor Relations Board in implementing the federal labor laws. It is a broad preemption doctrine, broader than most, in that it preempts both federal law and state law that is inconsistent with the federal labor law.
And why was this a kind of claim that had to be taken to the National Labor Relations Board?
It is a claim that the wage scale, collectively bargained for wage scale, was depressed by unlawful conduct of the employer, IBP. A claim that the employer has not bargained in good faith to set wages or other terms of employment.
Wait, I don't understand the claim that the employer hasn't bargained in good faith. This is a claim that because of the downward sloping law of demand, if you increase the supply of something, you depress the price. The employer is alleged to have increased the supply, the price is depressed, it's bargained in perfect good faith with the union, but demand and supply schedules meet at a different and lower place. So why is that something that goes to the National Labor Relations Board?
The first answer is, Your Honor, it need not be something that I can show is an unfair labor practice. The question is whether it is arguably an unfair labor practice. And the allegation here is that IBP is engaged in this scheme to hire illegal workers for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to drive down the collectively bargained wage scale. And it is that nexus, that is, that the scheme is being perpetrated solely for purposes of driving down the collectively bargained wage scale, that creates an arguable unfair labor practice. The board has repeatedly looked at both at the bargaining table and away from the bargaining table conduct in determining whether and not.
If you were to go to the labor board's precedents, what would be your best case for the proposition that the labor board thinks it is an unfair labor practice either to expand the supply of labor so as to drive the price down or contract the supply of labor so as to drive the wage up?
I have no case on point one way or the other, quite frankly. And to be honest, until this theory was advanced in a few cases brought by plaintiff's counsel.
On this rationale, of course, cases like Jewel P. and Pennington could not have been brought under the antitrust laws. They would have been preempted. It would have been Garmin preemption.
I don't know that that's necessarily the case. The question is,
on your argument, it is necessarily the case. Because the antitrust cases, the things like Jewel T and Pennington, involved supposed efforts to either drive up or drive down, and the Supreme Court has had them both under the antitrust laws, the supply schedule in a way that would affect the wage. And the Supreme Court has held that it's possible to bring antitrust cases. You have to get around Section 6 of the Clayton Act. But as I understand those antitrust cases, there's never been a thought that Garmin preemption would block them.
But it is also in shorthand that the board and then the Supreme Court addressed the question of whether or not an employer was engaged in an unlawful labor practice by using the immigrant status of its workforce in a coercive manner to secure rights it was not entitled to secure otherwise under the law. The premise of this case is that there would have been a bargain for rate of pay that would have been set at a level higher than the one that is set here, but for the scheme to depress that wage. That is, again, an arguable unfair labor practice.
Right, but of course the flip side of that, the driving up of wages, which was at stake in Jewel T, was said by the Supreme Court to be litigable under the antitrust laws.
That is correct. I think the question here is simply, in the case of first impression, and a case that raises an arguable unfair labor practice, that is a scheme designed solely for the purpose of depressing collectively bargained for wages, should that gray area claim be decided as a matter of jurisdiction by the board, as Garmin preemption suggests it should, or by the federal court. And I think another way to look at this and to see the interplay between what is happening here and the labor laws is to look backwards from the damage remedy here. The collective bargaining agreement set forth the wage scale at Article 29. And there is not a single wage scale, obviously, applicable to the unit. There are various wage scales for various job classifications at different skill levels. What plaintiffs propose is that a jury determine, in each instance, what was the appropriate wage scale for each of those job classifications, and then award as damages three times the difference between that and the wage scale that was negotiated by the union. So this is interfering directly with the central bargain for component of a collective bargaining agreement, the wages.
On your view, are there ever any cases that anyone can bring alleging the hiring of illegal aliens as a RICO predicate act? After Congress amended RICO to include violations of the immigration laws as RICO predicate acts, are there ever, is that just defunct because no one can ever bring the claim?
Oh, by no means. A competitor in commercial cleaning has already been able to bring a claim that its competitor was able to underbid it for work by having a workforce that was substantially, if not completely, illegal aliens. In Mendoza, an employee of a non-unionized employer was able to bring a claim of the sort that has been brought here.
I understand that. If your theory of Garmin preemption is right, the fact that there were no union doesn't matter. Garmin preemption applies to collective action, not just to unions. The National Labor Relations Board is not the National Union Relations Board.
That is correct, but the employer has not violated its duty to bargain with the collective bargaining unit in good faith in the absence of a collective bargaining unit. There's not an 8A5 claim, which is the one we claim would be applicable here. So Mendoza is different because of the absence of a union. Moving on to the RICO question, and especially the question of enterprise. There are two related but I think distinct problems with the enterprise allegations here. First, the enterprise is an association, in fact, allegedly comprised of IBP and mostly unnamed and unspecified employment agencies who are alleged to be acting under the direction and control of IBP. That is, they are alleged to be IBP's agents. So the entire enterprise is simply IBP and its agents engaged in a normal corporate function of human resource development of employees. Under Fitzgerald and other cases of this circuit, that is not an enterprise. A business corporation is not engaged in an enterprise activity merely because its normal course of business involves
agents. Who are they? Are they really just employees? What's this Chinese mutual aid?
They're not employees, nor in Fitzgerald were we talking about employees. In Fitzgerald, it was Chrysler and its independent dealers who were clearly neither affiliates nor subsidiaries. Dealerships are often independently owned companies, but they operate as agents of Chrysler. Here, the allegation is that the Chinese Mutual Aid Society and the other employment agencies are acting as the agents of IBP in connection with the enterprise. They are alleged to be acting directly under the control of IBP, who supposedly exerts great discipline over them, has its own employees on site to make sure they are carrying out IBP's wishes, and terminates them as soon as they cease doing so. So it meets all of the requirements of agency, and agency is all that Fitzgerald looks at. It says if a corporation in its normal business affairs does business through agents, that doesn't create an enterprise. In Fitzgerald, it was the distribution stream that included agents. Here, it's the human resources side of the company, but it's still a normal corporate function that is being carried on through the use of agents. Secondly, as RICO makes clear, the person here, IBP, must be conducting the affairs of the enterprise and not its own affairs through the pattern of racketeering activity. Here, the only racketeering activity alleged is a violation of Section 1324 of the Immigration Act. And that provision is violated by the knowing hiring of 10 or more employees over a 12-month period with knowledge that they have been brought into the country in violation of the immigration laws. The only party who can be violating that is IBP, because IBP is the only party that hires anyone here. So in committing the alleged predicate act, IBP is undoubtedly conducting only its own affairs of hiring. All the rest of this has just been put around it to create the appearance of an enterprise, but at most, the employment agencies facilitate IBP's alleged violation of the racketeering laws. They are, at most, conspirators, and as this court has, I think, repeatedly said, RICO is not a conspiracy statute. The person needs to be conducting the enterprise's affairs through a pattern of racketeering activity. And I think this can be contrasted with the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Mendoza. In Mendoza, what the situation presented was that there were defendant growers who used employment agencies in a similar fashion, with one critical distinction. The employment agencies there, the association in fact, were the ones who hired the workers and then loaned them to the persons, the defendant growers. So the defendant growers were clearly violating the RICO, the predicate racketeering act, through the hiring of the enterprise, by the enterprise of the workers. In this case, since IBP is the one that does the hiring, and since the only predicate act alleged is the illegal hiring of undocumented workers, it is only its own affairs that are being conducted. If there are no other questions, I would
One more. Sure. About your cross appeal. I appreciate the argument that this judgment ought to be on the merits. I just wonder how the district court came to think that preemption is a jurisdictional issue.
I think garment preemption is traditionally understood as a jurisdictional issue, a question of the exclusive jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board, and I think it is routinely raised as a 12B1 motion in the court. Now, whether that whole history is correct or not is another question.
Well, then I'm not sure I understand why you filed a cross-appeal if you think that. I had always thought it was pretty well established by the Supreme Court that preemption is an affirmative defense. It has nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction. This is a claim that arises under RICO, if it arises under anything. RICO is a federal law. 1331 gives federal courts jurisdiction, unless, of course, the claim is so laughable that it flunks the straight-face test and falls out under Bell against Hood. Preemption is just a defense. So I don't understand how this got set up the way it did.
I fully appreciate what Your Honor is saying. Let me try and answer it in two ways. One is that it is not clear to me that garment preemption is truly a preemption doctrine in the first instance. Preemption is generally understood as arising under the Supremacy Clause. When you're talking about preemption of one federal law by another, you're not talking about a Supremacy Clause.
You're then talking about implied repeal or supersession or something like
that. And you're looking for the intent of Congress at that point in saying that the labor laws are supposed to cover this whole field and we don't intend to cover it with other laws. I will tell you that the cases that have raised garment preemption have treated it as a question of subject matter jurisdiction because of the finding that the jurisdiction is exclusively vested in the National Labor Relations Board for any arguable unfair labor practice. And they have therefore dismissed it under 12B1, which is a dismissal with prejudice. Since a dismissal under 12B6 is a different form of relief, we were compelled to file a cross appeal to raise the issue before this court, since we would be seeking a dismissal with prejudice on the alternative grounds of the 12B6 motion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Foster? Mr. Foster, do you want to speak, if you would, to Mr. Johnson's distinction of the Mendoza case?
Mendoza held that workers who were non-unionized could bring this claim. Mr. Johnson says workers who are unionized cannot bring this claim, but he says he can't cite any authority from the National Labor Relations Board that would support his position. Indeed, if his position were correct, then all the Supreme Court cases that have held since 1938, including and Seventh Circuit decisions saying we do not sit in judgment of the terms of collective bargaining agreements, would be wrong, because this case seeks to change one of the terms of a collective bargaining agreement, the wage number, which the National Labor Relations Board simply cannot do. And for that reason, I don't have jurisdiction of this case. It can't be heard there. Mr. Johnson also says that anything having to do with wages has to go, his other argument is, to the NLRB first. You shouldn't be able to sue in court. I suppose if you were right about that, then no employee in a collectively bargained industry could ever bring a claim, say, for Title VII, arguing that they were discriminated against and they were paid the wrong wage rate because of their sex or their religion or something else.
Well, I specifically wanted you to focus, perhaps I didn't make it clear, on the enterprise distinction.
Oh, the RICO enterprise?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Judge Flom. The RICO enterprise alleged in this case is slightly different from the RICO enterprise that was alleged in Mendoza versus Zirkle. There it was an employment agency that was acting with the growers to recruit workers.
Right.
Here, instead of a formal employment agency, we have immigrant advocacy groups that are alleged to be recruiting illegal workers and referring them to IBP for employment. It's the same thing, essentially, except it doesn't call itself an employment agency per se, but the complaint alleges that the Chinese Mutual Aid Association is an immigrant advocacy group that supports the rights of workers who are undocumented or attempts to facilitate them in obtaining employment for undocumented illegal immigrants by referring them to companies that will hire them. IBP is one of those companies. Mr. Johnson can't distinguish that enterprise from what was alleged in Mendoza versus Zirkle or from the one in the Second Circuit.
Does that group, the Chinese advocacy group, actually have direct contact with IBP the way in Mendoza?
Yes.
Or do they speak, or do they contact the worker and advise them to show up at X plant for a job up?
Well, the complaint alleges, and Ms. Baker was in fact hired through the Chinese Mutual Aid Association, that IBP has an employee actually sitting in at the Chinese Mutual Aid Association screening candidates. When it finds candidates who come in who it thinks fit its worker profile, it then gives them an application and they fill it out on the spot. So IBP is using the Chinese Mutual Aid Association as a front and is directing the affairs just in the same way that or even perhaps more so, because in Mendoza there was no allegation that the growers had a person working at the employment agency sitting there all day long looking for candidates to come and work at depressed wages. Okay. I would just make one other point. Mr. Johnson says that the complaint alleges that the Chinese Mutual Aid Association and the other parts of the enterprise are agents. It doesn't allege that. For the court to construe it in that fashion would be to violate the Rule 12b-6. It would be construing it against the way it was drafted. And I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. Our thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.